Part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming the stylish cutting-edge string quartet Ethel, contemporary recorder ensemble quartet Next Generation, and pianist Angela Hewitt performing Book One of Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Seaboat, with a southern style of cooking catfish, chicken, and shrimp, featuring the Seaboat Sandwich, two pieces of fish on a wheat bun with lettuce, tomato, and tartar sauce, and desserts like sweet potato pie. The Seaboat at Bradley & Market in Champaign. Delivery and catering services at 351-6209.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. The term jihad, does it mean a personal struggle within oneself or violent struggle in the name of Islam, holy war, or inner spiritual struggle? On the program today, we're going to talk with an assistant professor of religious studies at Rice University about the interpretation and practice of jihad, past and present. Our guest is David Cook. He is the author of Understanding Jihad. Professor Cook's book looks into the historical, intellectual, and political meanings of jihad. And listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon, join the discussion. I welcome your telephone calls for David Cook. I look forward to your questions and comments. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area and would like to join the discussion, the telephone number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Understanding Jihad is published by the University of California Press. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Professor Cook, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Sure, sure. Does the meaning of jihad encompass both violent struggle and interpersonal struggle? Either one, both, somewhere in between?
Yes, it's a very fluid word. It basically means struggle, but it's come to have both of those different aspects to it. It's my opinion, and of course the I've backed it up inside the book, that the primary meaning is military, but it definitely has a spin-off spiritual aspect to it.
What would you like to tell us about changes in the meaning of jihad over time?
Well, like any religious concept, jihad is something that Muslims have interpreted in different ways as exigencies change. The early Muslim community was a fighting community. It expanded over the entire Middle East, created radical change in the physical and most especially religious landscape of the area that we presently call the Middle East, and that was accomplished through jihad. However, one has to also face the fact that throughout the vast history of Islam, most Muslims haven't actually been fighters at all. And so given the importance of jihad, other different interpretations have developed.
Now, how do Muslim scholars today define the word? How do they think about what constitutes jihad?
Well, Muslim scholars, just like Christian scholars and everybody else, are divided so strongly. Inside the Arab world, the dominant view is most strongly tended towards the military aspect. It's very rare in Arabic to find anybody who emphasizes inordinately the spiritual aspect of jihad. However, when one looks at materials, let's say in Turkish or Persian, or most especially coming out of the South Asian subcontinent, India, Pakistan, and so forth, then there's a striking tendency towards the more spiritual aspect.
Hmm. What does the Quran say about jihad and the militant part of it and the inner spiritual struggle part of it?
Well, the word jihad, at least in the sense that we talk about it today, doesn't really appear that often inside the Quran. There are teachings that later are interpreted as jihadic teachings, most especially in Surahs 8 and 9 and others that are associated with battles that the Prophet Muhammad fought during his lifetime. To a large degree, the word jihad, as far as the Quran goes, is a back projection. Doctrines that are concerned with jihad then are back projected inside the Quran, and the whole concept then is almost a later development.
Hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about what you mean by back projected?
I mean that when you have a group of terms, a group of ideas that there's descriptions of fighting inside the Quran, mm-hmm. quite a lot actually, but they aren't usually referred to by the term jihad, and so that sometimes throws people off. You know, if you ask, well, what does the Quran say about jihad? And you have to emphasize the fact that mm-hmm. the word jihad doesn't really appear that often inside the Quran. And so the term jihad, or the collective group of doctrines about jihad, then is projected back into the Quran, then reorganized. All the material about fighting then is organized under the title of jihad.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that the Quran talks about is justice. And I'm going to quote here from a quotation that you take from the book. Permission is given to those who fight because they are wronged.
Mm-hmm.
So, give us some background here. What persecution or persecutions did this passage stem from?
Well, the early Muslims, from the time when the Prophet Muhammad first preached in his hometown of Mecca, were very much a distinct minority, and they had to face a great deal of persecution from their pagan neighbors and relatives. And that ended up in the Muslim community actually immigrating from the city of Mecca to the oasis of Medina, about 150 miles to the north of it. And this was accomplished basically by the Muslims not having any, being able to take any of their goods with them. So there's a sense of injustice on that in that early stage of Islam, that they weren't able to take their goods and possessions with them, and had to recoup them through essentially attacking their former relatives.
Hmm. In this sense, then, does jihad bear some similarity to the ideal of a just war?
Yeah, I mean, I would define jihad as something like a regulated form of warfare that has defined sanction. There are numerous discussions about what is legal inside jihad, what is licit inside the legal books, and so forth. And all of them come down to the point that this is a type of warfare that is supported by God, and therefore it has to have a certain distinctive nature about it that sets it apart from any other type of warfare.
Hmm. And what are we to make of the verse that's known as Verse of the Sword?
Well, the Verse of the Sword has, as you can suspect, a lot of different interpretations. It basically sets the possible targets of jihad and the timeline in which they can be attacked, which is listed as 4 months after the proclamation is given. It is usually interpreted by classical Muslim scholars as being that Muslims can attack anyone who falls into those categories. The verse itself just lists infidels, which on the face of it would confine the fighting to a fairly small group. In other words, those pagans, those pagan Arabs. But in practice, it's been used throughout history to initiate conflict with those people, mainly Christians, in some cases Hindus and so forth, that have menace the Muslims in some ways.
And to quote a part of this verse, when the sacred months are over, kill the idolaters. Wherever you find them, take them captive, besiege them, and lie in wait for them at every point of observation. If they repent afterwards, perform the prayer and pay the alms, then release them. Allah is truly all-forgiving, merciful.
And it's important to read the last section of the caveat there that that is listed to be fair in how Muslims have dealt with that. But it also has been widely interpreted as an open-ended, or fairly open-ended, invitation to warfare.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Let me reintroduce our guest this afternoon, David Cook. He's an assistant professor of religious studies at Rice University. He is the author of Understanding Jihad, and that is our topic here this afternoon. We're talking about the interpretation and practice of jihad, past and present. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, also invited. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Another element of jihad that I think is very interesting is the element of redemption.
Yeah, that is very interesting. It isn't something that necessarily is accepted by all Muslims. It's, Islam doesn't usually emphasize a type of salvation the way that, for example, Christianity would. But there have certainly been certain elements within the Muslim heritage that have seen jihad as something of a salvational act. And acquiring martyrdom as obviously being the precondition for that.
Yeah. What would you like to know? What do you think are our misconceptions about martyrdom, the idea of martyrdom?
Well, the major misconception is what constitutes a martyr and how that plays out. Obviously, what comes to mind is suicide attacks, most commonly in the contemporary world. And are these people that commit suicide attacks, or what they're usually called in Arabic is martyrdom operations, are they really considered to be martyrs? And this comes down to the question, which is rather flimsy in contemporary Muslim literature, about what is their intention? And what is their intention at the moment at which they commit their act? If their intention is to lift the word of God to the highest, as is usually said, then their act by certain Muslim groups is said to be that of a martyr. But there are some problems with that. Actually, quite a lot of problems, and they come down to the rejection by the vast majority of Muslims of the idea that a person could commit suicide. And so if somebody actually pulls a trigger on themselves, then obviously they're a suicide, but if they push a button and blow themselves up, then they're a martyr, according to those radicals and so forth. And so this line of argument is problematic.
Yeah. What about violence against civilians, which is part of the suicide bomber or the martyrdom bombers?
Now, they justify that in a lot of different ways. First of all, against, like, democracies, they oftentimes feel that anybody who participates in a democracy is responsible for any of its actions. This is usually called the taxes argument or the voters argument, that if somebody votes for a given government, then they are responsible for its actions and therefore are legitimate targets, no longer civilians. This is how radical Muslims then justify things like September 11th and so forth. Other different arguments that they give are that that certain areas are targets for jihad, and those people that live in them, if they are not legitimate targets, simply shouldn't be there. If they are there, then they are legitimate targets, whether they're civilians or not.
Mm. Now, some Muslim clerics have recently condemned terrorist attacks committed in the name of Islam, and recently there was a group of North American clerics, U.S. and Canadian clerics, issuing a fatwa condemning terrorism and declaring suicide bombings impermissible. Now, in your book, you note that many Muslims reject the globalist radical Muslim claim to wage jihad, and citing the movement's apparent lack of legitimate authority to wage war, declaring jihad, you write, they argue is solely the prerogative of a Muslim leader, such as a legitimate imam or caliph.
Mm-hmm.
Jihad cannot legitimately be undertaken in the absence of a pronouncement by a recognized authority.
And this is a serious weakness. This is something that that Muslims who are not radical Muslims oftentimes point out as being problematic with regard to things like Al-Qaeda and other different extremist groups, is that they wage jihad without any particular legitimate authority, some sort of legitimate authority that would be derived or connected to God in some way or another, remembering that the definition of jihad could be regulated warfare with divine sanction. To these Muslim critics of the way that radicals wage jihad, then their actions lack that divine sanction.
Hmm. Now, some have said there's a struggle now underway for the soul of Islam in this sense. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, okay, I mean, I think that's a little bit overdramatic.
Yeah.
There's always a struggle for the soul of a religion that goes on all the time. Intellectually and religiously, that's a permanent feature of history. But, yeah, I mean, with that said, there is definitely opposition that's going on. I think it's been strengthened over the last year. Prior to that time, you did not find very many Muslims who would openly oppose the radicals in a way that would be useful. The problem with things like the American Muslim fatwa is the fact that it doesn't really necessarily have very much authority throughout the Muslim world. Mm-hmm. I accept the fact, for example, that American Muslims don't participate in these actions. It's very rare that we've found any American Muslims other than converts or people that had were passing through that have actually associated themselves with radical Islam in its violent sense. So overwhelmingly, American Muslims have simply avoided associating with any of these actions as far as we know.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't necessarily have that much spiritual authority over Muslims, let's say, in the Middle East or in South Asia or in Afghanistan or so forth,
let alone
in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. It seems though that it's a statement that needs to be made in North America.
It's a statement that needs to be made. It's a statement that definitely needs to be made because there's obviously widespread sentiment that certain Muslim groups, especially in the wake of September 11th, didn't do enough to deny or to reject extremism. And I have to admit, from my personal experience watching Muslims after September 11th, I wasn't just terribly impressed by the way that these people defended their position. And that's something that from reading Muslim publications and so forth, I believe that many Muslims would agree with me. So it's a maturation of the Muslim community, I think, that they feel the need to make such a public proclamation, even though I don't think that it has much effect on anybody who wasn't already convinced.
Mm. Let's talk with a listener. We have a caller waiting for us in Charleston on line 4. Good afternoon.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to suggest to your guest, and the subject of religion per se, and now with Muslim uprisings and the fallout from all of that, that is a comment or a study in human culture. In my opinion, the religion as a narcotic used by those in authority to maintain their power, as and Marx's term, the opiate of the people, which keeps most of us in, or most of the human population in upper childhood or early juvenilism. Would you have any comment on that?
Well, yeah, as you say, this is a Marxist opinion. I don't know precisely where you're going with that with regard to jihad.
Well, because it's a perfect living example of the childish behavior.
Yeah, but
I want what I want, and I don't give a damn what I have to do to get it and to keep it. And religion fits that, in Marx's term again, as an opiate or a narcotic that continues to decimate the advance of culture.
Well, but don't forget that the jihad is actually a fighting process, and so for a person who's being drugged or receiving such a drug, they're also essentially losing their life. So I'm not sure that analogy necessarily holds. I can understand how it might hold a certain population, let's say, that's being held in medieval or semi-medieval bondage by various different antiquated religious doctrines.
Okay, then we go.
But I'm not sure that would include jihad necessarily.
Well, then the other side of that is what's going on in the U.S. to this day. The evangelicals, which is an extremist version of Christianity, always has been from the time of Calvin. You know, the Catholics were what they were until the Reformation. And here come then the evangelicals and those hardliners who persist to this day, and the White House is full of that stuff. And where is that taking us? Only to the acceptance of what is happening in Iraq, that somehow they're going to be converted to democracy and then become just like the U.S. You know, I see these newscasts and all this stuff happening in the Middle East, which I don't blame those people for resisting, but they want the executive types, the political types, and other authoritarian figures dressed in three-piece suits. You know, the last time I looked up, the Middle East was full of robes and turbans and beards, and which was symbolic of their culture. And suddenly, our jihadist movements are now converting those people into westernized clones.
Well, I'm not sure whether that was a question or a comment.
Yeah. Yeah, well, let me turn it around and let me ask this question. Is jihad at all similar to military, political, and spiritual conquest in other religions?
One would have to say yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say that, yes, it does bear. It's been fruitfully compared to comparable doctrines, for example, as you mentioned, the just war. Others would compare it to certain elements in Zen Buddhism and so forth. I mean, it's definitely a doctrine of war that has prior antecedents and continues to have contemporary ones.
Hmm. Now, Islam, let's go back into history. Islam built huge empires.
Yes, the great Muslim conquests between approximately 632 and the 730s conquered the entire area that we contemporarily call the Middle East, even up into Europe, including Spain and parts of southern Italy. And obviously this was done through an aggressive jihad. And so in other areas of the Muslim world were conquered similarly. Ethiopia, for example, had to face the Ethiopian jihad. Areas of West Africa, parts of India, for example, and other places as well.
Now, did the architects of these great empires invoke jihad?
On the balance, yes. There are certain scholarly caveats with regard to ones like the Ottoman Empire, which, although its conquests have similarities to jihad, many scholars reject the idea that this was an actual jihad. But certain conquerors, like Sheikh Osman Danfodio, of the area that we now would call northern Nigeria, or others in India, invoked the actual language of jihad and described their conquests as actual jihad.
Mm.
And that's not to speak, obviously, of the early Islamic conquests, which were more closely associated with that.
Yeah. You want to say anything further about the ideology behind these conquests and how jihad, what jihad meant at that point?
Well, in the end, we don't really know that much about the ideology. Some of it we have to take materials that were composed at a later time and put them back into sometimes a situation 100 years before. The fact is we have virtually nothing that survived from the actual conquests from the late 7th century and early 8th century. And so although we have this ideology and we have an extraordinary series of conquests that really changed the landscape of the Middle East, it is a problem to know precisely what the ideology was. We would love to have some sort of statements or actual historical documentation of what prominent commanders were saying to their soldiers and so forth as they were going out to battle. That is lacking. But we have this ideology that's coming out of the Quran, coming out of the prophetic tradition literature, and in some cases is reflected inside the history books, and it plausibly explains the sort of conquest that we see.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is David Cook, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Rice University and the author of Understanding Jihad. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk now with a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Oh, hi. How are you? When your earlier definitions of or trying to define the word jihad and how it's applied is sort of to me like another example of how language is extremely inefficient, and you can be it can be co-opted by individuals or groups, or like Al Qaeda using the term jihad for their anti-Western, I guess you could say, tirade or whatever, a little war on the West. But I'm beginning to think that a lot of this stuff is really related to a rejection of modernism, where you have this these modern scientific societies who are basically, you know, exploding across the planet, per se, to use that cliche, but sort of alienating the people who don't understand or not technically proficient or left out of the loop. They're going to spend their whole lives in poverty or whatever, uneducated. And so they're subject to these sort of religious explanations for things. So you could use American fundamentalists as that way, again, you know, anti-evolution, that kind of stuff. But I'm wondering if you think a lot of these Muslims feel that way. I mean, I know Osama bin Laden has supposedly used this this historical September 11th is actually a historically significant date in Islamic history, something to do with the 19th century, I think the Ottoman Empire collapsing or something like that. But they sort of use this sort of maligned historical perspective to describe the reasons for what they're doing. And I just, do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, well, I don't think that that radical Islamic groups like Al-Qaeda can necessarily be called anti-modernist.
Mm-hmm.
These are oftentimes the people that comprise it are basically oftentimes very highly educated people who actually do embrace a certain modernism. That what they reject is the political domination.
Yeah.
But they would like to, in essence, assimilate Western science and technology just to make it Muslim.
Oh, I see.
And so I don't know. I mean, there are certainly elements that are anti-modernist within the Muslim world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, probably the best example is Abdullah bin Baz, who was revealed as an anti-Copernican. He was the chief mufti of Saudi Arabia until he died in 1999. And he wrote very prominently a book explaining how the Earth was orbited by the sun. But at any rate, I mean, so there are groups like that that are clearly anti-modernist.
Mm-hmm.
in nature. But I don't think that necessarily radical Muslims, at least under al-Qaeda, can be grouped with them.
So would then they be anti-modern politically then, like they're against the, let's say, liberal democracy where everybody is tolerant?
Yeah, they definitely, I mean, by the nature of their claims, they have to be anti-democracy.
Yeah, okay. So they're sort of looking for like the caliphate of the world, right? They're sort of searching for that.
For them, the Sharia-based society is going to be a true society. I mean, it's not going to be something that can be subjected to the political whim of the population. They could possibly, let's say, vote against it. That's inconceivable. And so it's understandable the reasons why they are hostile to democracy.
Yeah, I was wondering because, you know, in the 15th century and the 16th century, Islam was, you know, the preeminent society that, you know, we call the Arabic alphabet, which actually is a Hindu alphabet, but I mean, and the, or the number system, rather, and things like that. I mean, they were basically, you know, algebra is named after a Muslim scholar, and then all of a sudden they kind of fade out of view. Do you think that there's sort of, would they look at that as a political thing? I mean, the radicals or the people that are trying to promote Islam as the preeminent religion or way of thinking, Sharia and all that stuff? I mean, is that sort of what this is about? Or?
Well, they don't have a plausible explanation for the reasons why. I mean, there's been a lot of scientific and historical issues with, discussion of the reasons why Muslim civilization didn't make the leap into modernity.
Yeah.
Because it clearly was advanced far beyond European society at that particular time.
Yeah, and it's very interesting to see that. There's like a really narrow window of time, maybe 100 years or so, where they were like, to me at least from what I read, they were seen like the apex of, you know, they even had tolerance.
There have been scholarly speculations. They haven't been actually proved, but that Copernicus actually did take his calculations from different Muslim scholars and mathematicians and astronomers.
Yeah.
Well, and different others, you know, clearly are intellectually dependent upon their Arab predecessors.
Yeah, and I think historically the Europeans adapted that very quickly and then adapted everything else. I mean, we're just great adapters. I mean, our social, our economic systems and stuff. And I mean, the West seems to be to take the best of and discard the rest. And I'm just wondering, it seemed to be interesting that there would be some way to sort of not, you know, this guy did this or this group of people, but it seems to me that Islam just sort of like stopped like the Chinese kind of did, I guess, supposedly, you know, they supposedly did a few little tours and then they came back and said, nobody leaves, and became insular. And I'm wondering if it became like a religious insularity or if it was a political insularity. I'm just wondering, I mean, if you had anything, I thoughts on that.
Well, Islam definitely does change gradually after the 14th, 15th century. That was the period when Islam actually became the majority faith within the Muslim-controlled territory, remembering that the conversion to Islam lagged considerably behind the actual control over territory. And so many scholars would see that that earlier phase as being one in which Islam was much more open, much more of a multicultural type of society in which Jews and Christians and oftentimes Zoroastrians or others participated quite fully in the society, whereas later that opportunity was not present, and that contributed significantly to the hardening of the arteries, as it were, during the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries. But there are no entirely satisfactory explanations from a historical point of view that have been offered as yet, because it isn't necessarily true that every single Muslim area went into some sort of decline. I mean, you still had the Ottoman Empire that was adapting things and very much part of the European cultural community in that sense, and also obviously those in India as well. So it's a question that really remains open. Yeah. I've never seen any radical Muslims who've tried to seriously analyze it, and it's a painful question for Muslims to answer as well. I mean, the entire community. Why exactly did this preeminence fade after a certain amount of time?
Yeah. Well, what role was there a role to be played here by persecution in Europe and the Crusades?
Well, I mean, what role do you mean by the Crusades?
Well, how did Muslims respond?
Well, I mean, obviously the Crusades were part of a series of counterattacks that were mm-hmm. launched or encouraged by the papacy during the 11th, 12th centuries. And, you know, so we're talking about a whole series of wars, both in Spain and Sicily, and then obviously in the area of Syria-Palestine, too. And, you know, so and this was coupled together at the same time as the Mongol invasions were also decimating the eastern part of the Muslim world. But we can't necessarily see those things as influencing the scientific accomplishments of the Muslim world. I mean, for example, some of the most brilliant scientific accomplishments happened under the Mongols, or were encouraged by various different Turkish warlords and so forth. And so, although politically Islam was at a low point in the 12th and 13th centuries, intellectually it was still preeminent.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on a cell phone, line 2. Good afternoon.
Well,
hi.
I had a quick question.
Sure.
You mentioned that the you didn't have certain writings from the commanders in the field and things like that. The Catholic or Christian Bible had undergone several transformations or codifications or whatever. Did the Quran undergo similar, shall we say, shifts or recombinations or reshufflings of its content?
Because that's a great question. Mm-hmm. The fact is that right now we're working. There's some people that are working on a good edition of the Quran. And so that's very apropos, actually, that there's never been a serious scientific edition of the Quran, taking into account all of its different variant readings and so forth. Mm. But the text that we have right now is remarkably stable, and most scholars cautiously believe that it did come together or was coalesced somewhere around the 650s. And the reasons for that are varied and may change as a result of further manuscript discoveries. But the Quran itself has not been redacted as much as the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament has, or at least the evidence of it has not been discovered by scholars. Its form is pretty stable, with a couple of exceptions that are known from various different medieval commentaries and so forth. So
it wasn't, there wasn't some, shall we say, post-writing to justify after-the-fact kind of additions or...
Well, the interesting thing about the Quran is that it doesn't mention the great Muslim conquests. And, I mean, these were, the great Muslim conquests are really the formative aspect of early Islam, other than the experience of the Prophet Muhammad. And the fact that it doesn't do that or doesn't seem to allude to them in any way in an ex post facto manner is convincing, at least to me, that it wasn't touched up very much. And that's pretty remarkable because, as I say, these conquests are really the things that created the impetus for Islamization, the visible proof that Islam really was a revelation from God was really these conquests. And consequently, I mean, Muslims really are very defensive, actually, with regard to the conquests. But the fact that they aren't mentioned inside the Quran, they aren't prophesied, as it were, in the way that you find so often in ancient texts, indicates very strongly to me that they aren't, that this is a book that hasn't been touched up that much.
Okay. Thank you again.
Next, we talk with another listener on a cell phone, line 3. Hi. Line 3?
Hello?
Hello? Yeah, go ahead. I don't think we have that listener there. Let's go and take another call. Let's go to a listener in Champaign on line 1. Hi.
Hi. You had mentioned earlier that regarding the lack of textual evidence concerning what the commanders have stated for during the earliest jihad. I'm not sure if you're able to read Arabic or if you have access to Arabic text, but there are a number of books out there from our statements, at least from Khalid ibn al-Walid and other people. But in terms of the actual instance of jihad, we have to remember that when I was traveling through the Middle East, people usually always refer to jihad, peace be with Allah, jihad in the cause of, or in the path of God. And there's supposed to be a sincerity there. And also we have to remember that with jihad, with actual jihad, there are laws and regulations concerning warfare that you don't find in any other religious text in terms of how to treat the captives, what you're allowed to kill, who you're allowed to kill, so on and so forth. But like I said, I think what we have here in America is, yes, you have these people who are committing these horrific acts, and when they're talking about the concept of jihad, they're not talking about it in the sense of what it really is and what it actually should be. And jihad really, in the concept of the jihadin that you have now, is, in my opinion, is no different than trying to spread democracy. When you talk to many of these people, what they're talking about is they're fighting America because of the atrocities that America has committed in the Middle East, and they're not focusing their attention on Norway or Sweden or many of these other countries in South America. If I'm wrong, please correct me, and I'll listen on the phone. Thank you.
Yeah, well, what you're saying is, of course, I read Arabic perfectly, is talking about the early Islamic stuff. It's dated from considerably after the fact. It's true that we do have speeches, of course, that are purported to be from these early commanders. The problem is that they don't stand up to historical examination, and many of them are strongly suspected to be from a later date. What we lack is materials that are actually dated from that particular time. There's plenty of material that gives us an idea of what jihad was seen, let's say, in the 8th or 9th century. There's extremely little, and most of it from Christian sources, that it's actually dated from the 7th century. So that's what I was mentioning right there. As a matter of fact, really, there's virtually nothing except for a couple of papyri. As far as jihad being a regulated form of warfare, I agree with you completely. It's exactly what I said. But it is not true that jihad stands out in terms of comparison to other forms of warfare. One would have to say that from a historical point of view, other formulations of warfare, such as St. Augustine's The Just War and so forth, are remarkably similar, actually, to jihad and have oftentimes been compared to it. And so I don't know that necessarily I would say that that is unique to Islam. It's something that I think is true, that jihad is regulated warfare, but I don't think that it's necessarily unique. As for the reasons why the Mujahideen fight, whether they fight American injustice and whether they're fighting for democracy, I'm not sure that I'd like to hear why you believe that. I'm sure that certain groups of them do fight for various different reasons, but when you're talking about radical Muslims, especially associated with Al-Qaeda, there's no question but that they fight Western countries overall, and of course they have directed various different terrorist attacks at just about every country in Europe, whether they were those that are participating in the Iraq War or not. And so I don't know necessarily that that's something that is quite operative there.
Hmm. I have a couple of other calls, and I'm sorry, we've just run out of time, and we're not going to be able to get to those listeners and to take their calls, their questions this afternoon, because we've just run out of time. Professor Cook, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me.
David Cook has been our guest this afternoon. He's an assistant professor of religious studies at Rice University. He is the author of Understanding Jihad. The book is published by the University of California Press. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. Quiet day at the Chicago Board of Trade today. Futures in the soft red winter wheat pit trading to a high price of 346 and three quarters in the December. Fairly narrow trading range for the day at 342 and three quarters on the low price. The settlement price in what's been termed as low volume at $3.45 for the wheat. They were off 2.25 today. The March futures are 360 high, low at 356 and a half. Settlement price there, $3.59 and a quarter. They were off 2.25 in the May futures in the wheat pit, 366 and a half the high. The low at 364, settlement price at 366 and a half. They were down 2. And the July contract, 372 and a half the high, the low at 369. Settlement price at $3.71 and a half, down 2 cents for the day. September futures, 377 and a half the high, the low at 375. Settlement price at 377 and a half, and they were off a penny and a half. From the corn pit, futures unchanged, mostly to down a penny in the nearby December contract. 206 and a quarter the high, the low at 204 and a half. Settlement price at 204 and three quarters. They were off 1 for the day. The rest of the pit was down, but only about 0.75 cents. The March contract, 219 the high, the low at 217 and a quarter, and the March corn settled at $2.17 and three quarters. They were off 0.75 cents. May contract, 227 on the high, the low at 225 and a quarter. Settlement price for the May corn at $2.25 and a half cents, down 0.75 cents. In July futures, a 234 high, low at 232 and a quarter. Their settlement at $2.32 and a half, off 0.75 cents today. September corn, 240 and a half for next year on the high. Low at 239 and a half and a settlement price at 239 and three quarters. They were unchanged. And the new crop December corn for 2006, 249 and three quarters. The high, the low at 248 and a half. Settlement price there at 248 and three quarters. They were down a quarter. December oats for the day, 169 the high, the low at 165 and a half. Settlement price at 168 and a quarter, up 3.5 cents. In the March, a 172 and a half high, low at 171. Settlement price for that March oat contract at 172 and a quarter. They were up 2.25. Now the soy complex, November soybeans up a penny today, 567 and a half the high, the low at 562. Settlement price there at 563 and a half. They were up 1 by the end of the day. January futures, 578 and a quarter the high, low at 573. Settlement price at $5.75, and they were 0.75 cents higher. The March contract in the bean pit, a 587 high, low at $5.82. Settlement price, 582 and 3/4. They were up a half. And the May soybeans, 592 on the high, the low at 587. Settlement price there at $5.88 and a quarter. And they were up 0.75 cents. July futures were down a half for next year, 597 the high, the low at 592. Settled on that low at $5.92 a bushel in the July soybeans. They were down a half cent in the August contract, unchanged. 596 and a half the high, the low at 589. August 2006 soybeans settled on the low at $5.89 a bushel, and they were unchanged on the day. During the closing market report this afternoon, we'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois, as we always do on Wednesday afternoons. Kay Whitlock will join us from Terre Haute Grain to talk about the cash grain market, and we'll have an update on the closing potentials for FSA offices across the nation. As you probably well know by now, USDA is looking at closing a great number of FSA offices. Dave Dickey will have a really complete look at what's been happening in that area, and three stories that you can't miss, two on your countercyclical and direct payments, and then an update from Emerson Napsiger, extension agronomist here on campus, taking a look at an update of the nitrogen formula that Illinois has been using for about 2.5-3 decades now. There will be some new numbers for that, ranges, and I will give you a complete look at how that lays out and how you might save a little money this year trying to put your nitrogen on. I know that's costing a great deal of money, so you might want to stay with us during the closing market report this afternoon. That starts at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock today. Bean meal October contract, a 163.30.90 high, low at 162.30. Settlement price at 162.80. That was off 90 for the day. December bean meal down 60 cents, 166.10, the settlement price there. October bean oil, 24.31, the high, the low at 23.80. Settlement price on that low. They were up 5 for the day. And the December bean oil contract, 24.55, the high, the low at 24.07, settlement price at 24, up 18. Recapping very quickly the numbers from the board. Futures in the wheat pit were anywhere between a penny and a half and 2.25. Lower corn futures were down a penny in the nearby December contract to off a quarter in the far deferred contract. And beans finished anywhere between unchanged to up a penny for the day. Now, here with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, Todd. Cattle were lower today. Lean hogs and February bellies finished up. October feeder cattle, 117.55, the high, 116.95, the low, the settlement, 117.10, that down 47.5. November, 116.35, the high, 115.75, the low, 115.87.5, the settlement, that down 55. And January feeder cattle, 113.45, the high, 112.85, the low, 113.20, the settlement, that down 45. October live cattle, 90.90, the high, 89.95, the low, the settlement, 90.30, that down 65. December, 91.62.5, the high, 90.70, the low, 91.05, the settlement, that down 40. October lean hog, 68.35, the high, 67.35, the low, 68.20, the settlement, that up 17.5. December, 65.65, the high, 64.55, the low, 65.32.5, the settlement, that finishing 52.5 higher on the day. February lean hog, 67.87.5, the high, the low, 66.60, the settlement, 67.77.5, that up 42.5. April, 67.10, the high, 65.90, the low, the settlement, 66.97.5, that finishing up 22.5. And February bellies were up 157.5 today. The high, 96.87.5, the low, 94.90, 96.37.5. The settlement today, that up 157.5. The Dow is off 46 points at 10,395. The NASDAQ down 18 at 2121. The S&P 500 down 8 points at 1206.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, helping to create a storehouse of possibilities and products from a single seed. ADM, resourceful by nature.
You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. It's 2 minutes before 2 o'clock. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Henry Frayne is our technical director this afternoon, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Mike Sola's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon: in northwestern and west central Illinois, becoming partly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms late in the day. Elsewhere, mostly sunny, very warm and humid, highs between 84 and 90. Tonight in Illinois and western Indiana, mostly cloudy with scattered showers and thunderstorms. In the remainder of Indiana, partly to mostly cloudy with showers and thunderstorms arriving overnight. Lows tonight ranging from 42 in northwestern Illinois to 62 in southern Indiana. Tomorrow in northern and central Illinois, becoming partly to mostly sunny. Elsewhere, mostly cloudy with some lingering showers early, then clearing and turning cooler. Highs ranging from near 50 in northwestern Illinois to 78 in southeastern Indiana. In Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, mostly sunny, continued very warm and humid, the high 87, winds southerly at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, increasing cloudiness with a chance for isolated thunderstorms this evening, then showers and thunderstorms likely overnight, the low near 50, winds